This week's episode of the Nerdist Writers Panel is brought to you by T-Fury. T-Fury is the original pop culture t-shirt destination, selling unique designs every day since 2008. You can snag their shirts for only 24 hours, starting at midnight each day. Missing a shirt from the past and want to get it again? Head to the T-Fury Gallery, where you can buy some old designs still in print and vote on others to come back from the dead. Every 2 to 4 weeks, T-Fury adds more designs to their gallery, so be sure to keep an eye out for the return of your favorite shirts. But you should really just buy them the first time around. So visit T-Fury every day and then get a shirt, because it's gone after 24 hours. T-Fury shirts cover all of your favorite topics and fandoms. They've got everything from gaming, sci-fi, anime, TV, movies, pop culture, and more. Their t-shirts change daily, so check back as often as you'd like. Daily. Also, don't forget about the T-Fury After Hours sale. If you miss the day's shirt by only a little, they keep the sale going into the wee hours of the morning just for you. Check out tfury.com/nerdist and see what today's shirt is all about.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Writers Panel. This is Ben Blacker, the creator and moderator of the Nerdist Writers Panel. Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter, at Ben Blacker, just like it sounds. I myself am a TV writer. I've written for the shows Supernatural, Super Ninjas, and I'm currently working on a DreamWorks animated program, which I will tell you more about when I'm allowed to, but it's a lot of fun. I'm also the co-creator of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, a stage program in the style of old-time radio, available as a podcast on the Nerdist Network, monthly at Largo, and touring all over the country in 2014. Find out more at thrillingadventurehour.com. Up, I'm doing a live Nerdist Writers Panel at the Emerald City Comic Con. It's on the Friday of the con, and it's going to be really cool. We've got a great lineup. We have Cullen Bunn, Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue DeConnick, and Greg Rucka. It's on Friday, the 28th of March, Emerald City Comic Con for badge holders. And if you are going to Emerald City in Seattle, come out to see the great Thrilling Adventure Hour Welcome to Night Vale crossover. This is one big show. Thrilling Adventure Hour and Night Vale is written by me and Acker and by Jeffrey and Joseph, the creators of Night Vale. It's on Saturday, March 29th in Seattle. You don't need a badge to go. Buy tickets for the Moore Theater. If you go to our website, thrillingadventurehour.com, there's a link for tickets. A bunch of the Work Juice players are coming up. Mark Edmund Jackson, Mark Gagliardi, Craig Kakowski. People you love, plus some special guests are coming with us. Molly Quinn will be there, Castle's Molly Quinn, and renowned fangirl Molly Quinn. And I'm not saying Alan Tudyk will be in the show, but he's going to be at the con, so, you know, he's a pal. You never know what's going to go on. So come and check that out. That's Seattle on March 29th, and the Nerdist Writers Panel is the day preceding at the con. Join us for that. As ever, I want to hear what you guys think of this show. Leave a review on iTunes or find me on Twitter at Ben Blacker and tell me what you want us to talk about, you know, there. Or go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/NerdistWritersPanel. I am done talking, except for the podcast you're about to hear. Thanks for listening.
It's the Nerdist Writers Panel on the Nerdist Podcast Channel. Ben Blacker talking writing with writers. Writers talking writing can get pretty exciting. The talk can be lightning. It's very, very frightening. Ben Blacker talking writing with writers. Yeah.
Our old pal is back. You know him from such programs as Buffy the Vampire Slayer, CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, Pushing Daisies, Charlie's Angels, most recently American Horror Story, and there's even more. Please welcome back our old friend, Douglas Petrie. Welcome back, Doug. It's nice to see you. Get comfortable.
Thank you.
Say hello so the people know what you sound like.
Hi, I'm Doug Petrie. This is what I sound like. I sound just like this.
With a background on Star Trek, Voyager, and Enterprise.
Among other credits, these guys have worked on Terra Nova and Nikita. They're currently working on the pilot for Sci-Fi's television version of 12 Monkeys. Please welcome Travis Fickett and Terry Metalis.
Hello, I'm Travis Fickett.
I'm Terry.
And finally, with credits including Dark Angel, The Twilight Zone, Medium, and others, our final panelist has worked in a lot of genre shows that you guys love, including Castle, Hawaii Five-O, and Arrow. Please welcome Moira Kerlin. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you guys all for being here. Let's get to it. I want to ask you guys the most pressing questions that I have. And Doug, let's start with you.
Let's.
Tell us about, I think you were not working on American Horror Story when last we spoke.
Yeah, I was working on movies last we spoke.
That's right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about American Horror Story.
Let's.
We don't care for movies here.
No.
We're a TV-loving audience of people.
Good.
But let's talk about M. Hosto. Call it that, right? what were you coming off of? What were you most recently staffed on? And then what were you...
Oh, interesting.
And then you're moving to American Horror Story. Tell me about the difference from those.
Yeah, well, worked on the short-lived Charlie's Angels, and then which was fascinating. It really was.
The show or the process?
Both, actually. It was really, really interesting process to be part of this reboot. How's it going to work? What's it going to be? Does America want to see this? We got an answer pretty quickly. And every day I would just say, can we just have a hot chick on a motorcycle crash through a plate glass window? And they're like, no. Oh, okay.
It's fun. Actually, we should talk about this for a second, because
yes,
we're kind of far enough away from it that we can talk about the debacle.
Yeah.
The debacle. Debacle.
Debacle.
That was
in Wisconsin.
Charlie's
it's
Angel.
A debacle. Yes.
Because the guys behind it,
love those guys.
Yeah, who created Smallville.
Yeah.
Smart guys.
Super smart.
They actually had a really great take on the show. Like the script, the pilot script that they wrote was really good. I don't know if that's why you got involved, because you liked that or you liked them. But like, I remember reading that and meeting them, and they were really good and seemed to have a good idea of what that show ought to be.
Yeah, I think they were hemmed in, honestly, by the network and by what the network wanted and what the studio wanted. And kind of it was an example of they were in a really tough spot where and this happens a lot when you the more players you bring into a project, and you guys probably know this as well, the more opinions you get. And sometimes that's when you're incredibly lucky. You get this great synthesis, but as with many lucky, you know, instances, that's really rare. And what happens is if you get a bunch of entities who can't quite agree on what this is, including, you know, it was a television series, it was a series of movies. Drew Barrymore was involved. Everybody had ABC. You had Sony, plus the cast, plus the new creators, plus Josh Friedman had written a script which apparently was amazing, dark and gritty, and apparently awesome.
Wow. And read that.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, like let's see that. And he like killed the original angels in the opening scene, I think, and then the new angels came in.
I read it.
It's great, right?
It is. It was great. Yeah, it was fascinating.
Right.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, and apparently it's an amazing script. And it was, you know, Drew Barrymore read it, and her eyelashes fell off. You know,
yeah.
So that did not go well. So they kind of, given that they tried an extremely cool version that didn't work, kind of everyone's like, don't do anything cool, you know? And you get, I'm kind of half kidding, where they were like, don't do anything that's going to really rock the boat. And you're like, then why do this at all? Because we've seen it before. Also, there was this thing where Charlie's Angels was a hit in the 70s because, and we're completely serious, there was no internet porn. So, right?
True.
So I'm
Jacqueline
dating myself.
Smith in a bathing suit.
It's Jacqueline Smith. It was called
in that white bathing suit,
and it was called Jiggle TV.
Yeah.
And if you were a horny 11-year-old boy, which everybody was in the 70s,
100% of people,
even the chicks, were like horny.
No, I've never missed an episode.
Right.
I love that show
because that show turned you into a horny 11-year-old boy, and which.
Well, I liked watching girls kick butt. But that was That was for the girls.
Good backpedal. But no.
It had something for everyone.
Yeah, so did I. I was there for the empowerment.
They're taking away your
Buffy
card.
I'm a bigger liar than you are. But really, there was no porn. So if you wanted to watch cleavage and jiggling and Farrah Fawcett's nipples seen through sheer material, you tuned into ABC on Wednesday nights. And
I want to watch that.
Yeah. You know what? We're done. Let's watch. And now it was kind of like, okay, so it can't be, you know, it can't be titillating, because titillating is boring. You know, it's like I can go watch crazy shit on, you know, the internet. So why would I watch it for that? So, okay, so that's kind of out. You can still do a sexy show, but if you want to be sexy, then it's got to be character-based. And what those characters were, you know, we had a very simple model. It's like, how about they kick ass as cops? They're just like out of, you know, pushing guys' heads through windshields, like just crazy badass cops, but their personal lives are a mess. I was like, okay, well, you know, cool. We'll watch that. And what happens is you get so many entities that they're all kind of everyone, and also it was very expensive. So this is the kind of double-edged sword, and I'm sure you guys want to, you know about this as well. When you get what you want, it's scary because more money is involved and more people are involved. And the more money and the more people are involved, the more cautious the project will become. And that's tough. So if you ever see something that's really cool, that's big budget, that you really think is amazing, like just take a moment to go like, wow, somebody got that through, you know? Yeah. Which is why I loved Pushing Daisies so much. When Pushing Daisies ended, we all had our picture. And it was crazy, crazy making that show. And I love Brian Fuller to this day. And at the end, we had our picture taken in front of the pie hole. You know, it was like, hey, it's called the pie hole. It's dirty. You know, they got so much stuff, got away with so much stuff. And, you know, it was like all the crazy stuff on that show. And when it was done, we had our picture taken. I was very moved, you know, because I had this overwhelming feeling of love for Brian and what he had done, because it was ABC. And it was like, wow, he got, you know, what was he saying? There's gay porn that's less gay than that show. You know? Wow. We used to come in like, this show can't get gayer. And it's like, we're going to have a murder between two window dressers. I was like, I was wrong. It got like, wow. Fantastic. But it was created with so much, like this very singular kind of love, and that Brian got that through on ABC, and that he got it on the air at all, let alone
renewed
yeah. and intact and beloved and all that. And the guys, Alan Miles, and if you're listening, Alan Miles, I love you to this day, but they were in a position of having to play defense all the time. And everybody was playing defense. And this is what happens with a lot of shows, especially on network.
Yeah, I'd like to pick this up for a second, because all of you guys have had this experience. You know, we kind of got to see Terra Nova from before it started
there
to it after it ended.
There it is.
You know, we had...
There's one clapping.
Silverstein.
Who's that?
We had Silverstein and Furion, all of whom did drafts and had a part in it. And then we had, you know, Grelong was on, who had worked on the show. What was the experience like for you guys, you know, with... There were so many entities with a hand in this show.
You described it to a T. Yeah. There, you know, it's a lot of money, a lot of big names. You know, Spielberg, Chernin, and a studio and a network. And ultimately, it comes down to it needed a singular vision to really go. And the original creator, Craig Silverstein, had gone off and done Nikita. Kelly Marcel had gone off and done, you know.
Even before there were dinosaurs, Marcel cut and run.
Right, exactly. you know, so it was the same thing. The more money there's a lot of voices. And, you know, there was actually about 3 or 4 seasons of Terra Nova that you guys didn't get to see because they kept reinventing the show, is why it was so delayed. Mm-hmm. I mean, we broke a whole season with Matt Olmsted, who is, you know, Chicago Fire and Breakout
PD
Games.
Now, yeah. Chicago
yeah.
PD.
And totally different show. Like, you know, that was like The Shield with dinosaurs. It was like this really cool. You guys would have loved
it. It really was. Yeah. It was
so cool.
That was before we knew it was going to air at 8. Like, we didn't... There was a whole 20 weeks, you know, you come in and they say, okay, we're going to put together a staff. And this is before Paul Grelong got on board, before it was run by Rene Echevarria. Mm-hmm. And they were like, okay, there was no pilot. There was Craig's script, which they wanted rewritten and mm-hmm. sort of redone, and they didn't know what it was going to be. And in between, mm-hmm. I get... Well, no, right before it started, I mean, it was not... going to be a Spielberg thing. It was this thing that, you know, Kelly Marcel had dreamed up and Craig had had written with her. And then Spielberg got involved. Apparently, he's really big. So once that happened, and then
likes dinosaurs,
and then another, you know, 800-pound gorilla.
He's all opinionated.
Yeah, he's all opinionated.
Let me tell you how it's done.
Yeah, yeah, like he knows.
Yeah, like he knows what he's doing.
And so we did. We did like, I'm trying to think. Like just so many ideas for episodes and what it might. We had no idea who the characters were. I think we knew Jason O'Mara,
right?
And that was and Allison Miller. And that was
You're talking about the first 20 weeks. Actually, there were two. We happened to be on both of those writing staffs, but there was a whole season that just got trashed, and then they went and made the pilot. So go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they were like, okay, look, this isn't working. So that whole staff goes home, and we were like, I guess it's done. And then there's an urban legend about the fact that somebody had ordered lumber in Australia, and they couldn't send it back. And so they're like, we have to make this show now. Yeah. And it was so they went and they made the pilot, and it was off to the races. And
yeah, I mean, the thing we did hear about at the time before the show had even aired was this escalation of commitment, which may take its, you know, the lumber metaphor may come from that. But what was it like, you know, the day to day in the room? You guys were creating seasons. Did it feel like this is never going to happen? And did you feel the various hands in it? Because, you know, you guys were just writers.
You always felt the various hands. I mean, because there were so many different points of view about where it could go. You know, the network, I mean, there was a very sort of infamous call that we got at one point, was the network had said, we want Little House on the Prairie with this family. Which is not something we had really envisioned the show to be. But, you know, there's a way to go on that. If, you know, you go back to the original, like, Little House on the Prairie books, those are dark as hell, man. There's, like, wolves surrounding houses and Blizzards. Babies go. I mean, it's really
raw and kind of
really
cool.
Hardcore. So there's a way to go there.
That's not where they wanted to go.
That's not what they meant.
That's
not the Little House on the Prairie they want.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then Spielberg, you know, it was actually really involved in the beginning. You know, and with constant notes. And then, you know, I think he had to go make Lincoln. And then at that point, it was sort of like, you know, I remember on one call he said his difference of opinion was that the network was saying, we want a family show. Nobody seemed to know what kind of family show that was, whether it was a family that doesn't get along or a family that does get along, and we want to love this family. But he said something really interesting on one call, which was, today's family show is lost. You know, I want mystery. I want all that. And I remember thinking, like, yeah, it is. It really isn't like a, you know.
It doesn't have to be a mother, a father.
Or Seventh Heaven.
It's a different kind of family unit that, you know, every show ultimately ends up being that way. And in every pitch, you end up saying, it's really about family. That's what they want to hear that. They need to hear that. Yeah. So
I think the showrunners, they had a lot of masters to serve. And ultimately, I think we got there. I mean, by the end of that season, if anyone actually, like, stuck through, we got there. And there's someone applying.
That's crazy. That one.
That guy.
We got there. We got to...
We'll pay you later.
We were, like, shooting people in the head, and we're going for it. But I think it was just too far, too little, too late. And that's what happened.
And this, you know, again, to come back to the main thesis here, like, this seems to be the way that television is looking. I mean, you look at the pilots that were picked up this year, and I would say the majority of them are based on existing material. And have a lot of entities involved, production companies and studios and networks and so many different things. Let's talk about Arrow for just a moment, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You were there from the beginning of it.
Yes.
And it could not have been easy to bring what I think people thought was going to be a pretty big franchise. You know, Smallville was gone. And this was supposed to kind of pick up the baton, if I'm not mistaken.
In a sense, I think there were there is a lot of money behind it, these shows, and there's a lot of expectations, and there's a tremendous amount of fear. Mm-hmm. And it's you're really dealing with people at the studio and at the network and even at the production companies who just want to keep their jobs. Mm-hmm. And I get that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but it can make for a less creative atmosphere. It's very hard to think. They want you to think outside the box, but not too far outside the box. You know, it's like the Charlie's Angels thing. So they want it to be cool, but not too cool. Yeah, you know. And so I think there was I was only there for the first 13 episodes, and I was hired. I specifically said in the meeting, "Great guys, I met with Mark Guggenheim and Andrew Kreisberg, and I said I don't know anything about comic books. I know about boys in pain, and I can write that, and I love to watch it, and I'm really in. That just sounds
love to cause it.
You know, billowing coke, king of pain. That's my thing. So I'll be there for you with that. But I don't know anything about." This guy and this island, and I don't know anything about, and the arrows. I don't know anything about it.
The arrows.
And, well, that was sort of my, it was like, can we give him a gun? You know, because he has no superpowers. I mean, there's a whole, you know, it was a whole thing about he has no superpowers. We didn't want any villains that had superpowers. And I think the idea was when they originally conceived of it was that it was going to be much more, there was going to be a procedural case every week. And that was sort of why I was brought on. And the more they started to develop it, working with the network and with the studio and the network did want sort of another Smallville, although this was clearly going to be darker and, you know, more adult. But they also wanted, there's that CW paradigm. You know, in Act 5, no matter what's going on, Oliver needs to go to a party. And somebody there needs to say something that he doesn't want to hear, you know, there, or it's a secret, or, you know, he's going to see somebody kissing somebody else. And, you know, that all has to happen. I actually don't know if it's still happening on the show, but it was certainly, if you watch the first 13 episodes, there's a very, like, he's got the name in the book, and he's got the party in Act 5, and he's got a lesson to learn, and there's a lot of stuff. There were a lot of hoops that these guys were going through, and it is you are finding the show. So the launch of a show, particularly something that's complicated like that, is very, very difficult. And that first season is extremely hard. I mean, I did it on Dark Angel too. It's very hard, and there are expectations, and even when you air and you get the great number, they don't relax or anything. I mean, it's not like they're going terrific now. You know, go ahead. Next, you know, there's even more notes next week because now we have that number. We don't want you to drop. We don't, you know, whatever you did that you did right, you just need to keep doing that. And so there's a constant pushing and pulling and just trying to figure it out. And you are working together as a team. You know, you have to, you know.
Can we talk for a second? I mean, you've been there for the launch of a number of shows. That's always a tough
process. I've been mostly lucky that they've gone, because that's a big thing. Is getting the biggest thing in television writing is getting yourself on a show that goes past one season. I mean, that's a huge deal.
That's true.
And you know, if there's no skill to it, you take the job they offer you. You know, it's not like you go, oh no, I know that one's going to be a hit. You know, that's not really how it works.
If you knew that, you'd be in a different business.
I would. It's true, and I'd be richer.
Can you compare, though, launching a show like Dark Angel, which has this sort of heavy mythology and a lot of rules to get across, to something like Castle, which is such a clear concept?
I think, I mean, to a certain extent, any show that has a heavy mythology is going to be harder in a way. I mean, the nice thing about Castle was, you know, he likes her, she likes him, but they don't want to admit it, and there's a murder. where it comes.
I could listen to you boil down premises all day.
Maybe we should do that.
I mean, if you want to get me started on like craziness, I'll talk about trying to break a Medium episode. And we used to literally take 6 weeks to break one of those episodes. You all don't appreciate it.
We'll get to that.
Nobody appreciates
it. I do want to hear about that.
How hard we worked. We'll get to that one. But in a sense, it is just as hard because. There are all the people at the studio and at the production company at the network, and they want to hit. They don't want to have to get that call. They don't, you know, they desperately want this to work. And you are, even on a show like Castle, figuring out what the show is. And if you watch the show, I think if you go back and you watch that first season, it's much darker. The cases were really sort of, they were a little bit, I don't know, they were just a little rougher, you know. And then in season two, Renee Echevarria came on, and he had a sort of a lighter touch to it, and I think that's really where we sort of figured out what the balance of the humor and the casework was. And we started to understand, somebody would pitch something and you could start to immediately go, that's not a Castle show. That's not a Castle crime. It needs to be more, something like this or twisty or whatever it is, but you could hear a pitch and know immediately, nah, that's not right. Tonally, that's just not right. But there is that process that first year of figuring it out, because in the first year, you don't know what's right. You don't know instinctively what will work and what won't. I mean, not that we know what will work all the time. We don't. But you start to figure out
what that show is.
Exactly. The first year is always about figuring out what the show is. Even with somebody who, like on Medium, I mean, Glenn Caron's a brilliant guy, and he had a lot of that stuff in his head. But we still had to figure out what the show was. Mm-hmm. I know. Mm-hmm. That's just what happened.
To that end, I mean, you guys have written a pilot that is... Has 12 Monkeys been picked up yet, or are we still waiting to hear?
Unless you've heard something.
Right. Yeah. No.
We're waiting, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we turned it in. We shot... We're really, really proud of how it came out, and the network was really happy, the studio was really happy, and now it goes into that mysterious testing process where... Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the Midwest, someone's handed an iPad and they watch your pilot and decide its fate. Yeah. So it's
they don't watch it on the iPad, do they?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of the very worst way they can watch it. And imagine that and accept it in my heart that that's how it's... Right.
Can we talk for a second about that pilot specifically and maybe trying to get ahead of the conversations that will follow when it does get picked up and figuring out that language of the show? How do you start to put that into the pilot? How do you start to present, here's what the show is in a pilot? What was it like for you guys on that show?
Figuring out the language of the show probably started in pitching it. Mm-hmm. You know, and we had to have a lot of conversations, just he and I, about this is Travis and Terry and I, talking about, you know, what is this from week to week? What is the series?
What's the mythology? I mean, it's tricky when it's time travel.
And serialized time travel.
And serialized time travels. You've got to think pretty far ahead. We were super lucky with that. The network, they were like, this is great. When they went actually bought the script, they were like, we're going to pay you to write a massive Bible and figure all that out. Wow. So that they can be convinced and that we can be convinced that there is three seasons worth of show there.
That's great.
So once you've done that, then you kind of look back at that pilot. You're like, we need to put this in,
Yeah,
it's actually amazing if you can do that, if you have those three seasons ahead, because then you really can.
And they teamed us up with Natalie Chaidez, who was responsible, you know, she was on the first season of Heroes and the first season of Sarah Connor. And she's done, you know, she's kind of built her career launching a lot of shows too, and she's sort of been on that, on the ground for those kinds of things. So, I mean, just Heroes and Sarah Connor alone, it was a lot of things where she's like, oh, this is how this works. And she was familiar with so much of that terrain, I think, that it was...
Yeah, so what did you guys take out of those conversations with her?
Well, she's on as an executive producer, so, I mean, we are still having those conversations. What did we take out of it?
That you could apply to that pilot or to the Bible, you know, to know about the show as you move forward.
I mean, it's sort of, I mean, we wrote the Bible, you know, the three of us together. So there wasn't necessarily a rule like, here's what you cannot do. You will make a huge mistake. I think what you do is you draw upon what works. You know, there was there's actually a famous Brian Fuller episode of Heroes.
Company Man.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, that is a, you know, something to strive for. And same thing with the way that, you know, Sarah Connor Chronicles use their time travel, you know. There's, you know, and it's so funny to do this time travel thing right now, because I remember there was a time in like the late 90s, like you couldn't go near time travel.
We still kind of hear it.
They're so scared.
It comes up on these panels once in a while.
And the networks would be like, whoa, I don't get that. And we do have those conversations with, you know, development execs. They're like, I don't understand that. They're like, look, Marty McFly comes back from 1955. He looks and he sees his other self. Okay. It's that. You've known it, you know, it's interesting because you have an audience now that's been, lost to the season of time travel. Yeah.
Lost tricked everyone. They were like, oh, by the way, we're a time travel show. Like season four or whatever. Yeah. Like they just decided.
So I think those conversations would come to that conversation. Like, this can work. This is how it's worked in the past. And here's how we need to incorporate that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I want to pick up where we left off, Doug.
Sure.
We've talked about the beginnings of shows. And you're coming to American Horror Story in its third season.
Yes.
How was that for you?
it was fantastic. I mean, it was kind of a dream come true. You know, came on Buffy season 3 mm-hmm. as well, and
so the show knows what it is at this point. Well, even something like American Horror Story, which can
like
be
American
anything.
Horror Story. Well, I gotta slightly disagree with you on that. In the most glorious way, it doesn't know what it is because mm-hmm. It's so great. Ryan Murphy is the real thing, and legend has it. I was a big fan of season 1 of American Horror Story. Had nothing to do with it other than enjoying it immensely on iTunes, just binge watching it. And the story goes that about halfway through the season, you know, it's a family moves into a haunted house, and about halfway through the season, major characters are getting killed, and someone said, how are you going to come back next year? And he goes, oh, we're not coming back next year. Next year, it's a lunatic asylum in 1964. Huh? You know. And but it's the Mercury Players, you know, so you got the same actors or the same core of actors playing different roles the following year. And we just started working on season 4 of American Horror Story, which is completely different from anything we've done before. So when I came on, season 3 was Coven, and it was Asylum was I thought Asylum was fantastic. It got a ton of nominations. I think Sarah Paulson, in particular, just crushed it. Jessica Lange was great, as always. The Name Game episode was just mind-blowingly good. And the arcs of the whole show, it got very, very dark, even by my taste. I like it dark, but that was a lot to stomach. And then paid off in kind of the most glorious emotional ways at the end, and the most empowered and the most satisfying. And then season 3, you just kind of throw all that out and say, well, let's try making it literally lighter, where Asylum, if you've seen Asylum, it's as dark as this room is now. You know, it's literally dark. And season 3 was bright, wide, open spaces, lots of day shots, lots of sunshine. The witches all wore black, but they were in this beautiful, you know, palatial white room all the time. So you had in the visual palette, in the tone, everything was lighter, and many more jokes in season 3.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it was just funnier.
Was that something that was kind of agreed upon? Like we want to make this season funny?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was really conscious. Let's give Jessica more zingers. Let's give her more jokes. We were happy to do it. Although Tim Minear, raise your hand or scream out loud if you've met Tim Minear. He is the most adorable. I love him to death. And if he's Tim, if you can hear this now, I love you to death. He hates it when I say that to him. Because he can't stand love. And when I saw season 1, I ran into a party. And I saw season 1. I said, hey, what are you doing? He said, I'm working on American Horror Story. I said, oh, I should watch it. And I watched it. And I said, this show is amazing. I loved season 1. And I sent him, I ran into him again. I said, your show is unbelievably good and unbelievably scary. And there was a pause. And he said, but funny, no? I was like, yeah, no, it's a lot of laughs in my house when my wife has sex with the rubber man. You know? Was it me? She doesn't care.
You know, that classic comedy trope of bloody
like you
face.
Do. Like you do. Since the 1930s, they've been, yeah, hilarious. It's Bob Hope stuff. But, you know, there's a dark humor, even in Asylum, very dark humor, but it really is there. And this year we just brought it up where the characters themselves are witty. It's not black humor situational. It's more like the characters themselves are funny, and they enjoy – they're kind of deliciously evil, and they enjoy being evil. And we really enjoyed writing them.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it was all conscious decisions. And then next year is – I got to tell you, we just started season 4. We will find it. And it's going to be awesome, and we don't know what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear about how the seasons come together, because the anthology season is such an interesting idea, the season-by-season anthology.
Yeah.
It seems like you guys kind of, or the staff kind of hits on, this is the area we're doing, this is the genre we're doing. We're doing witches this year, or we're doing Asylum this
yes,
year.
Yes, very much.
What is it for 4? I know it's been announced, I can't remember what it is.
I can say nothing
it's
about it.
It's been announced.
No, it
so,
has.
Right?
Because, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know
what'd
if it's
you
true,
hear?
But I heard Carnival.
Yes, it does not have a title.
Okay,
But it will be.
But that's the setting.
That's the idea. Yeah. Very roughly, that's the idea.
So it seems like you guys kind of start with that, and then like what comes next? Do you start talking about characters? Do you start talking about tropes of horror?
Both of those, very much. I mean, to use an example, last year in Coven, Evan Peters' character, we very much wanted him to be Frankenstein. You know, he's this frat boy who gets literally blown apart and then put back together with other frat boy parts and, you know, all the obvious jokes ensue. And we had all these crazy talks because nothing is too extreme on American Horror Story. So people were saying, well, like, if he's got this other frat boy's hands, do the hands commit murder? You know, it's like, but then we're doing this other thing, you know, so what is this really? And we talked a lot about, I don't know how much of this showed up on the screen, and Evan, I can't say enough great things about his performance because he had like grunts and moans and whispers and just broke your heart with every one of them, you know. We talked a lot about Frankenstein, you know, the both the novel and the original black and white movie and kind of how heartbreaking Frankenstein was. And we really got into like, let's have him kill a kid. You know, let's have it be Halloween night, and he kills a kid because he's trying to play with a kid, but he doesn't understand. And it was too. We couldn't go there. We couldn't go there.
This season wouldn't hold it.
This season wouldn't hold it. Yeah. Perhaps last season would have. Maybe next season will. I couldn't say. But it's that kind of thing. So we talk about tropes all the time. There is not a famous classic horror movie from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, last decade, whatever that thing was, where we won't steal everything. We'll steal all the furniture. We'll steal the, you know, anything that's not nailed down. And then we'll pull up the nails and steal those too. You know, we're completely happy to do it. And then we kind of invariably find it and make it our own. So to any, you know, would-be or wannabe writers or writers in process, including ourselves, you know, like I've become a lot bolder about writing something down and going, oh, I can't do that. I saw that in Reservoir Dogs. Or, oh, I can't do that. I saw that in Star Wars or whatever. Go ahead. You know? Go ahead. Because those guys did, you know?
You're going to make it your own in the doing it.
You're going to make it your own. So
well, you put your name on the script.
Sure.
So
that's the first step. Yeah.
As long as you get paid. I think that's what we're getting at here. So it really, as long as you do make it your own, and I think, you know, you look at Raiders of the Lost Ark, how many Hitchcock and Disney movies are shot for shot are in there? The Matrix. I mean, the list goes on and on. Every Tarantino movie, which I enjoy thoroughly, and he's a complete American original.
Yet he's a patchwork of all of his influences.
Yeah, absolutely. He's the mashup king.
Mara, tell us about stuff that you were into as a youth. What were you reading and watching on television? And do you remember when you first recognized that things are written, and maybe that's something that you could do?
Well, my father is a writer.
So you knew.
He was a playwright, so I always knew that things were written. yeah, I wanted to be Glenn Larson, I guess. I was very into Battlestar Galactica, the original. I watched Charlie's Angels. I watched Battlestar Galactica until they hooked up Starbuck with Cassiopeia, and then I was like, out. Because I liked Athena. So if there had been an internet, trust me, I would have blown it up. But there was nobody, and my friends didn't even like it, so I had nobody to talk to. And I watched The Bionic Woman. That was a big thing for me. Interestingly, I watched a lot of genre shows, and then later when I eventually became a writer, the first thing I wrote that I could show anybody that wasn't embarrassing was a script about it was a feature, and it was about a kid who sees a ghost, basically. And it's this love story. He goes to this small town, and there's this girl, and she's dead. And it's this whole love story. But then I was always saying, I don't want to do genre. I don't want to do genre. And
why did you resist it?
I don't know. I wanted to do cop shows. I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. My first job was Dark Angel, which, of course, was genre. But I was like, I got to get out of genre. And then I went to Dead Zone. And it's just more people with visions. And I did Haunted, and he sees ghosts. And, you know, I got to get out of this. And then I got to Medium, and Medium was sort of in both worlds, where it was a little bit of genre and a little bit of procedural. And as I became less genre and more procedural, I began to truly appreciate. This is sort of why I wanted to go on Arrow, because I was like, genre is ordinary people in extraordinary situations. It's the best kind of drama there is. And so that was sort of what got me into it, even though I treated it like a little redheaded stepchild. But it really was genre that sort of made me want to write. And F. Scott Fitzgerald. Loved F. Scott Fitzgerald. Big thing. So
That first script that you weren't embarrassed to show people, how much writing of your own did you do before that?
I was writing The Great American Novel. I was going to be the voice of my generation. And I don't know if anybody has tried to write a novel. But you get into this circular thing where you're just rewriting and rewriting. You have no deadline. You have no, you know, and you don't really know where you're going because you're inexperienced. And it's very, very difficult to write a novel. And I met the man who would become my future ex-husband, a marvelous writer, director, really, really talented guy named Fred Decker. And he said, a novel? Don't be stupid. Write a feature. You know, it's done. You write the end. You sell it. They give you money. I mean, you know, don't be dumb. And he sort of helped me figure out how to, with all the lessons that he had stolen from William Goldman, which he freely admits. And he sort of helped me along with it. And I wrote a terrible cop drama. Then I wrote a terrible family drama.
These were feature.
They
scripts.
Were features, and I know where the family drama is. I think the cop drama is lost to history. It was on a floppy, and it's I don't know what happened to it. And then finally, I wrote this little drama about this tortured young man who basically is suicidal and meets this girl who's a ghost, and she wants to come back to life. And it's sort of how they help each other accept their situation, basically. And there's drag racing, and it was very sort of sweet. If you read it now with Gossip Girl and all these, you would be like, oh, that's quaint. That's really sweet, what she wrote. I mean, it was so innocent now when I look back on it. But it got me a bunch of jobs. It was, and I sold it to New Line. But they didn't make it. They didn't make it. And then I was like, this is ridiculous. I had been working at Stephen Bochco Productions, and I actually hired Matt Olmsted. Oh. Yeah, for NYPD Blue.
In what capacity were you working?
I started out as she was Dana Flanagan then, and then became Dana Bochco, but she was running his company. And I started out as her assistant. It was the first job. I had come out to California and gotten myself a copy of the Hollywood Creative Directory. Mm-hmm. Which is, again, I'm just dating myself with everything I say.
That doesn't exist anymore.
You all know how old I am now. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a list of every production company and every studio in Hollywood with all the people that you would write to for the job. And you would send out a letter and a resume. You know, you'd stamp it and print it out on the computer. And I didn't have a typewriter. I had a computer. And I sent out like 100 resumes, and she happened to be – they were just starting Bochco Productions. And they were making Doogie Howser. And she hired me, and I started as her assistant, and then I became, I guess I was a development executive. There wasn't a whole lot of development to do, but I mostly hired writers for the shows. And I was there for 10 years, and that's how I met Chick Egley, who co-created Murder One, and then eventually went off and started a company with James Cameron and did Dark Angel. And so he hired me to come. He read my script about the boy in love with the ghost and hired me to work.
And you had you written TV before that? Or you had to just
I
done
had
these
written,
features?
Now I'm going to date myself again. I had written a spec episode of Profiler.
Nice.
if anybody remembers that.
The Thrillogy, right?
Huh?
Wasn't that the Thrillogy? Profiler? It was Profiler?
I think it was the Thrillogy. But what was the other?
Pretender, Profiler, Pretender. Another P show. And then it was like they just rotated.
There
like,
was nothing thrilling about the Pretender.
Proctologist.
That's just very, yeah, no. Yeah, so I had written that, and then I wrote a spec NYPD Blue because I was working at the show. But that was, no, I had never written television until I didn't realize that. I thought I wanted to be a feature writer. Mm-hmm. First I was going to be a novelist, and then I was going to be a feature writer. But I realized how much I miss getting a weekly paycheck. And in feature writing, they do not send you a check every week. No, you get, you know, hopefully a big check, and it's supposed to last you. And I was like, no, that's not going to work for me. I need that check. And so TV was good for that.
So what
until
was it
you're
like?
Canceled, and then you're, you know, nobody's sending you anything.
What was it like being in that room for the first time?
It was great. I mean, it was a very easy entry for me because Chick knew me and liked me and
you knew the world having been in the Bochco camp.
I mean actually he spared me the pain of having to go through being a staff writer because he said you know too much. I'm going to make you a story editor, which I don't even think he could do now because it's money. So I didn't even have to deal with the staff writer job. I just came in as a story editor and it was great. I mean, I think when I look back on it, Jose Molina will certainly agree with me. I mean, it was me and Jose Molina, David Zabel, who went on to run ER and is a really talented writer, and Doris Egan, who's also a brilliant writer. And we were so obnoxious. We were so obnoxious. And Renee Echevarria was so sweet to us and really just listened to us when we were giving him a hard time when he knew so much more than we did. And there was a lot of like, well, you know, they did that on Buffy. You know, when they did that on Buffy, it was, you know, Chick finally said, I don't want to hear any more about that. And I couldn't blame him. I mean, it was just, you know, it was just, we were just awful. I mean, we were, you know, and you, but you learn so much. You learn how much you don't know. It's that, you know, it's that old story, you know. It's like going through your 20s. You learn all the things you don't know, and you start to figure out how much you have to learn and how lucky you are to be sitting here with these people who are willing to teach you. So,
that's great.
Yeah, James Cameron was great. He was awesome.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah,
no, was he very involved with the show?
Well, he would come in. He would sort of come in, and he would be very involved. And he loves writers, and he loves writers' rooms. And he's just a really smart, fun guy to hang around with. And he'd be, you know, well, I gotta go. And then it was like, where's Jim? Well, he's at the bottom of the ocean. Okay, well, he told us, and then he would come back and go, where's all that stuff? And we were like, well, we tried it, and it didn't work. Well, this we didn't discuss. It was like, well, Jim, you know, we tried to call. And then literally it would be, again, you know, he'd come in and he'd be very, you know, he loved the show. He cared about the show, but he had other things to do, you know. And then it was like, well, where's Jim? Well, he's at NASA. He's talking about going into space. And then he would come back and say, oh, they have this thing called an exoskeleton. I think we should do it. And, you know, Logan can walk in season two. And, you know, I mean, he would come in with those were his ideas, you know. But, yeah, but he was fun. He was a good guy.
That's great. Let's hear from you guys. What are some of the early influences, and what was the stuff that you wrote individually and together?
You want to go first?
My influences are pretty embarrassing. I'm trying to think about like the
Dude,
first.
Dude, I had
thing.
The original Battlestar Galactica. You
know? No,
that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking Glenn like that moment, like where you come online and it'll be like somebody wrote that. I was like, what was that moment? And for me, it was this. I was nine. It was this animated show called Robotech, where was actually a Japanese animated show and was written in Japan, and they translated it for American kids to sell toys. But moms and dads had no idea what their kids were watching. It was before school and after school. And about a dozen episodes in, they brutally murdered one of the major characters. And my bus was coming. They realized, and like the character's like a brother figure, named Roy Foker, for anybody who knows.
He's still not over this.
I'm still not over it. And I just remember being so blown away because they didn't do that on kids shows. You know, it was a cartoon, and so I remember sort of that started to be the moment where I was like, well, who made that decision? Why did that happen? And then it became a big arc for that character in that show. But that was sort of the first moment for me.
And my turn?
Yeah.
I don't even really remember. I'm from Maine, so Stephen King has always been a thing. Most of that stuff's real, by the way. That's actually happens. But a couple of things that I remember is that I remember saying, holy cow, like that's, it struck me in such a way that made me think, well, I remember first thinking, I could never do that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And then this is really bizarre, and an old issue of a comic called Animal Man, sure, written by Grant Morrison. And if anyone remembers when he finished his run, and it was, he comes to talk to Animal Man and explain.
He had written himself into a corner.
Written himself into the comic. He didn't write himself. I don't know if he wrote himself into a corner, but he was kind of writing his way out of the series. He was like, you know, he was done. And Animal, he's like, haven't you? He's talking to Animal Man. He's like, haven't you ever thought about why nothing interesting happens to you when you're with the Justice League? And it's because you have terrible powers, and the other writers have no idea what to do with you. And then in 22 pages, it becomes a sort of Grant Morrison apologizing to Animal Man for all of the things that he's done to him. And it was horrifying how awful what he had done to this character. And he says, well, the truth is my cat was dying and I was mad. And so I took it out on you. And the final couple pages were just him sort of eulogizing and talking about his cat. And that,
it's
so underselling
brilliant.
This.
You guys should go check it out if you haven't.
And I remember just putting it down and being like, I can't believe that just fucking happened. Like he talked to me, and it was almost like a magic book, and I was so struck by it that yeah, from then on, I'm like, that. He was in that moment, like, the most powerful person in my personal history. And I'm like, now I must become that. And that was a big moment.
Travis tries to write himself into everything we write.
He's like, dude, stop putting yourself.
Nikita,
I'm chasing dinosaurs. Yeah. Like,
but what's interesting, I mean, even in those 22 pages, there's so much about what writing is and what a writer is and how Morrison sees writers and writing. Like, it's so wrapped up in that.
Yeah.
And it had been there all along, too. I mean, it's throughout those first 26 issues or whatever it is. But, like, I can absolutely see why that would be eye-opening.
Yeah, it was. It was that. I mean, you know, Stephen King does it sometimes, too, where he kind of steps in and the Gunslinger, he kind of shows up in that stuff. And then, you know, TV, like, I wanted to write movies as well, and I was sort of doing that. And I have a lot of unfinished screenplays. Terry and I knew each other since college, and he was sort of toiling away separate from me. And I didn't want to do TV. I didn't want to do, I don't know, it didn't interest me until I saw Buffy.
Wow. Cool.
And it was when season two ended and becoming parts one and two, and I was just like, fuck movies. I was just like, that is so amazing. I was so struck by that. And I remember thinking, how do I do that? I have no idea. And Terry was working in TV. And so we started having conversations about doing that, and then we started writing with each other through email.
Where were you?
I worked as a journalist. I think I was working. Was it IGN then? I forget.
You're asking me? I think you're right.
Yeah. I was working as a TV critic for IGN.com, which I did as a sort of, like, you know, I'm like, well, it's sort of close, I guess. They'll let me talk to people in TV and for pay. And then we just started writing back and forth through email, and then we kind of sat down and had a conversation about, if we were to do this seriously, how would we proceed? And it's a lot of work, and that's about it.
What was the first thing that you guys did write together? And I'm always curious to hear from partners what each of you, without getting into a fight or breaking it up, what do each of you bring to the partnership, or what do you think you bring to the partnership?
Well, the first thing we wrote really is we wrote this time travel spec, which is actually what started the whole 12 Monkeys development process. So that was kind of the first thing. And when we wrote it, it was, because it was a time travel spec, we had no intention of showing anybody in the world, because there was a paradox towards the end, and there's this big complicated thing. And I was like, nobody's ever going to get this. But we were writing it for ourselves, which I think is probably the most important lesson for any writers. Write what you want to see. So when we had finished that...
Because they might film it, because they did. They filmed this.
That was sort of the first thing. As far as what each
a
of
shield
us,
spec, too. We wrote a shield
we
spec.
We did write a shield that spec. That was badass, though. Yeah, it was so cool. You guys would have loved that episode. It was a Dutch and Mackie team up, and it was really good. But... as far as what we each...
That's called fan fiction now.
Yes.
Fan fiction.
Yeah.
It is fan fiction. I'll admit it. I think we each bring kind of the same stuff at different times to the partnership, you know? Like, there's... people are like, what is your process? And our process changes daily.
Yeah.
It's not like we'll sit down and we'll write the whole script together, we'll develop it all together, or we'll go off and write different scenes and come back. It just changes on the demand of whatever that story is, I think, for us.
I will say that I know people team up and decide to become partners. They might be on staff together, or they might be assistants together or something, and then they're like, hey, why don't we give this a go? I have no idea how they do that.
Yeah.
I've known him for 20 years.
Yeah, we were college roommates, so you got to be like... dude, you stink.
Yeah, this is terrible.
There's no filter, you know. And it's funny because the Nikita writers always would talk about our office, because we'd be bickering in there, it's actually really great to have this thing where it's like, no, that doesn't work. So you have this sort of quality control, I think, in a partnership. But, you know, there are days we want to kill each other.
Yeah.
But there are days where the other writes something and you're like, you're a god. Thank you. I had no idea. Yeah. I had no idea what that was, and you figured it out. So
I'll say one thing I know that Terry brings to the process is a and it's something that got famous in the Nikita writer's room, which they referred to it as Terry face. And it's an innate sense of
bold
what's working.
Things. this is the thing, huh?
And he would get this look of like
No.
For people listening, I'm scowling in kind of a bemused way.
It's not a scowl.
And
it's this. It's
and I used to hate it.
You're just trying to figure it out.
I used to hate it. I used
what?
To get so mad because I'd be like, no, this is working. This is working. And he'd be like, okay, let's do it. And we'd go down, and it wasn't working.
Yeah.
And so now I know, like, when you get that response, and he sometimes can't articulate what it is. Mm-hmm. He's just like, I know this isn't right. And then I've seen, like, showrunners, when we've been on staff, come to appreciate the same thing. And they're like, they get really worried. They're like,
appreciate. What? Might be a strong word.
Yeah.
It's more like, oh, for God's sakes, why the face? You know? And it's just like, well, are you sure, Mom, we want to do this?
Because I tend to be like really optimistic, like that might work. Let's try it. Let's go. All right, yeah. And I'm wrong a lot of the times. So it's good to have somebody who can say, don't go down that alley. It's bad. I'm telling you. I don't know why, but it's bad.
Doug, I'm curious about, you've worked on a number of staffs and some real powerhouse staffs, and you are such a strong like go-to guy on a staff. What do you think that you bring to a writer's room?
Wow. You'd have to ask the people I work with to get a better perspective.
What do you think you bring?
Awesomeness.
You smell nice.
Bags and bags of awesomeness and hygiene. What I bring is, I think what I always do, it's funny because I was talking about, with a showrunner who's staffing up now, and he asked me about some younger writers, whether I should hire them or not. And he said, what can you say that you like about them? And I think what they had is what I bring all the time is every show I've worked on shows that I'm proud of. I've worked on shows that I'd like to forget. I've worked on shows I'd like you to forget. and you have. I thank you for that. But always, I can kind of put all the stuff we were talking about at the beginning of the panel about you've got money, you've got reality. You know, you've got political reality, you've got studio reality, you've got financial realities, you've got crazy actors, you've got not crazy actors who have legitimate claims that you can't address. You have all this shit that's very, very hard to deal with. And what I bring to it every time is I ignore all of it. And what I do pretty much every day, and I'm really grateful that it's the way I'm built, and it sounds like it's the way you guys are built too, and maybe you guys in the audience are built this way too. I try to envision the best possible show imaginable. I always, what's the best thing you could see? And I always remember, I mean, it's different places at different times. Some of them are quite recent. I watched an episode of Game of Thrones that was literally breathtaking. And it was the end of the second season. And amongst all the spectacle, they did something that was just cinematic where someone's walking around a curved building and the person they're following disappears. A 12-year-old with a Super 8 camera could film the exact same thing. And it was the best special effect I'd ever seen. Mm. And then there was a shot where the White Walkers show up and this guy scrambles, the Sam, the fat wizard, scrambles behind a rock. And that shot itself, I literally gasped. Because I felt like I was watching The Empire Strikes Back again. It's that feeling. Whatever that feeling is. And usually it happens when you're a teenager. It can happen at different times. It happened to me last year. But that feeling, and I remember being 15, and this was the great, great thing about working on Buffy, is that people say, what was it like writing for Buffy? I was like, well, what's it like graduating from Hogwarts? Joss and everyone there, too many writers to name, but everyone came in there with this like tremendous love. What can we do this week that's just going to blow everyone's minds? And you talk about writing for yourself. It's like, what can we do right now that if I was my 15-year-old self or whether it was last year, it happened to me last year watching Game of Thrones, I was like, I just had my mind blown. It doesn't have to be when you're a teenager, but I think that's when it hits a lot of us the hardest and we never forget that moment, I always bring into the room, let's blow everyone away. Let's do something that just blows your mind. Let's do the best show. Let's go the furthest. Let's go the hardest. Let's go the funniest. Let's go the most heartbreaking. We're only here once. Let's do this. And I think that sometimes it can be intense. You know, sometimes you just like you want it so bad. I do have to thank everyone on the American Horror Story staff, because if you've seen this year, I got to tell you, Ryan Murphy came in once, and this is where I knew I was home. You know, because we've done some really sick shit, and I've enjoyed all of it. But you talk about that wanting to be in that environment, and I can't. If you want to be a writer, I can't encourage you enough. Whatever happens, bring that. Like, bring that, because that'll never die. And it'll get crushed 100 times, 1,000 times by this town. We will all tell you that. It's always true. But it rises 1,001 times. Like, always, always, always bring that. And Ryan Murphy came in, and we have a character, if you watch the show this year, named Myrtle, who's this crazy witch with red hair. And she's a regular. And we looked at her contract. It's like, Frances Conroy is in for 12 episodes. We're paying her. It's like, what do we do this week? He said, let's burn her alive at the stake. I'm like, yes. Let's kill her. Let's kill the shit out of her. Let's burn her. She's a witch. And we did. And then he put this Dr. John song under it, kind of in the right place at the wrong time or whatever. And like, whoa. And then she went up in this incredible pyre. And it's like, what do we do next week? He's like, we'll worry about that next week. And we brought her back. It's a witch show, you know.
Wow.
We brought her back. So I guess that's what I'm saying, and it seems like these guys have the same spirit, is remember, and this is really hard to remember, you know, but whether you're writing alone or writing on a staff or whatever, just remember that thing, you know, whether it was, you know, there's certain moments in Pulp Fiction where you just go, whoa, this guy loves movies so much, and it's infectious, you know. Remember what you loved to death, you know, what you would die for and what you loved more than anything. And I think that's what I trying to do that is what I bring.
I want to get some questions from you guys. But before I do want to talk about Medium, because I need to know.
Can I just say one thing, though?
Yes.
You know, Adam killed a little boy.
Is this a friend of yours?
No,
or?
Adam in season 4.
Yes.
He kills that little boy.
Yes.
Which, yes. That was...
Adam the Frankenstein.
Adam was a Frankenstein.
He kills that little boy to see how he works.
That's right.
And that is actually one of the creepiest things that happens in all 7 years of Buffy.
Yeah. Right.
And you don't even see it. It's a news report later. But I had to explain that to my daughter.
Yeah, Moira was saying back in the green room that she is watching Buffy with her 10-year-old daughter.
And my 70-something-year-old mother.
And everybody's loving it. And you're watching it for the second time.
Yeah, my daughter's absolutely obsessed. She was Buffy for Halloween. It was so awesome. I was so excited. I couldn't believe it. First she wanted to be a cat, and then she thought she'd be Buffy. And I was like, I'm going to get you the best costume. I was on eBay buying an $80 Mr. Pointy. And I spent so much money, and she looked great. So excited. The perfect hair. It's like, no, she had the side bangs. Yeah, it was a whole thing.
I feel so scared for the kids who went out dressed as vampires.
Most of them didn't get it, but there were several adults who looked at her and went, cool. She said she was very pleased.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I do want to hear about Medium and why it would take 6 weeks to break an episode.
That show...
This is eating at me.
Well, and part of it actually is what Doug was just talking about, which is... And Glenn Caron used to call it... There was a lot of turnover in the staff, and there were a lot of talented people on the staff who didn't work for whatever reason. But everybody who came in was he would call it a rigorousness of thinking. And what that sort of means in layman's terms is it's never good enough. That first idea is not good enough. You can always be smarter. It can always be twistier. It can always be more surprising. And there was a constant attempt to set up expectations in the audience. Oh, this is the episode where they do this, and then subvert them and do something different. And that was always the goal. Obviously, you can't hit it 22, or I think we did 24 at one season. I don't even know how we managed that. But there were episodes where somebody would have an idea, and it was so good that you're not pulling the ripcord. If it takes 6 weeks, it's going to take 6 weeks, and we'll write it over the weekend, or we'll do whatever we have to do. But it's we're not giving up on this, because this idea is so brilliant. We have to be smart enough to figure out a way to do this, or we need to turn in our Writers Guild cards.
Can you recall a specific instance of that?
No, it's all a big blur. I do remember
a lot of episodes.
I do remember my favorite story about Medium is just because it was this. I had written a script, and I had turned it in early, and Glenn had there were things about it he didn't like, and he wanted to change it. So we rebroke it, and I wrote another script. This is how early it was. It was the first script I wrote for season two, and he still wasn't happy with it. And now we were shooting. And so what you would and we would shoot in order on Medium. We would shoot the script in order because he was rewriting in order, and that was just how he wanted to do it. So it was, I mean, that was a huge production issue. But so we had on the board, we were rebreaking it again, and we had on the board things that were written in black were things that were already shot. There's nothing we could do about it. Things that were written in green were things we were going to shoot today or they were going to shoot tomorrow, and then the rest of it was all a big blur. And I was... The story had been kind of a sweet story about some friend of Allison's as a child, and she had faked her own death, and Allison finds her and all this other stuff. And in the meantime, there's this crime, and there's this girl who's missing. And we're literally staring at the board, and we're in, like, day two or three of shooting. And there's this long silence, and we're all staring at the board. And I can curse, right?
We encourage it.
All right. And I'm staring at the board, and I said... You know, I really think the only way this is going to work is if the father is fucking the daughter. And Renee Echevarria went, yeah, that's it. That's all we got. And the actor had already come in, God bless him, and was giving a performance in which he was not fucking his daughter. And we bring Glenn in. We're like, Glenn. And he was like, yeah, no, definitely. Now you finally hit on it, you know. And I appreciate the hard work. It was a yeoman's effort. That was his, you know. We're like, okay, well, it's day three of shooting, so we better get on this. And then we write these pages, and we send them off to the actor, and we send them on his fax machine, and his daughter picked them up, and all of a sudden, they were, you know. And he called, and he was mad, and we were like, no, but it's going to be a really good episode. And it was a good episode. It was a really good episode. It was one of my favorites, but it was hard, you know. And we did it with a smile on our faces. I mean, we were, you know, we were working hard, and we were getting it done, and we were proud of ourselves.
So if someone's throwing out an idea that you guys say, this is, or if Glenn says, you know, this is indelible, we need to do this idea, and it can't be broken in a week, what are the mechanics of the writing and production for that? Like, the train keeps going.
Well, the fascinating thing about working on Medium was that it was always, it took 10 days to shoot the show, but they would only budget for 8. So the call sheets would come out that were like, you know, day 10 of 8. And for us, that was great because it was like, wow, prep gets pushed, you know, because everything gets pushed. It all gets pushed. And then you get to the end of the year and you have a 2-week hiatus and you need to come back with a story. And it's, you know, it's June, it's May or what. In May, we were still working and still shooting. And so for production and for the actors, I think especially, it was hard on everybody, but it was harder on them. I mean, we were just up in the conference room getting free lunch, you know. So, and yeah, we worked some weekends, but for the most part, you couldn't work all night. You were exhausted. You'd really been working hard all day. You would go home. We would all have these crazy commutes. That was the big con because it was in Manhattan Beach. But we would be on the freeway for an hour, and we would call each other and go, I think I know how to fix the end of Act 3. Or you would wake up in the middle of the night and you would have this thought, and there wasn't texting then. But in the morning we would come and go, I think I got it. So there was a lot of that. We were 24 hours a day. We were thinking about Medium.
That's exhausting.
So.
All right, we have time for a couple of questions from you guys.
G'day. I was wondering if you could recall any specific practices from showrunners you've worked with that you've thought, when I run my own show, I'm either going to do that or make sure I don't do that.
Well-formed, very efficiently asked.
Wow. We'll be here all night.
Mine is actually another Renee Echevarria moment, which is we were shooting Terra Nova. They were shooting in Australia, and we were breaking an episode 8 or 9, I think. We were breaking, And the network decided they didn't like the mythology and what was coming in the season, and they wanted to throw all of it out and start sort of in a new place. And it was, I mean, it was, this was my first staff job, you know, and I think you...
I went home.
He went home. It was the middle of the night.
I couldn't hear Velociraptor or T-Rex or anything. I was done.
Soul-shattering kind of moment where you're just like, what do you do now? And Renee goes, he does this, yeah. And he goes, can we see dailies? Can we get the dailies? He wanted to make a chart of what had been written, what had been shot, what was shooting right now, because it's a world away, right? And they're shooting while we're there. And figure out what could be changed, what we're stuck with, and how to proceed. And never lost his cool. And it was sort of a mentality of like he cared and he was doing the job and really like was passionate about making this all work. But at the end of the day, it's television. Like we're not doing heart surgery. No one's going to die on the table tonight. And I just remember thinking, okay, that is the mindset that I'm going to, you know, take a photo of this, a mental picture of this, and remember, because I would have lost my shit at that point. And he didn't, so.
He would probably tell you that you need to be Cuban.
Maybe that's it.
That. Yeah,
honorary Cuban? Can you do
you
that?
Can, yeah, you can. I don't know how he does it, but it's true. I worked with him on 3 different shows. And I never saw him lose it. And what he never would do is visit his stress upon the writers.
Yeah.
We always felt that we were in a safe place with him. We always felt, and that was one of the things that when we were on Dark Angel and so many of us were just hammering on him. That's a stupid idea. That's a terrible idea. And one day I saw him. We were at Medium, and I would still fight with him about stuff. He was talking about an idea that I just thought was awful. I mean, God, it's terrible. It's not going to work. I'm sitting there like, you know, it's not going to work. And he would tease me. He's like, oh, there's Moira sitting with her arms crossed. And, you know, she hates this idea. And I was like, I do. I hate this idea. But Bruce Miller, who's also a wonderful writer, was just recently on Eureka and is developing. Great guy. Wonderful guy. And he went along with him. He was like, yeah, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. And it was very much, it was a little bit the face, because I was doing the face. And it didn't work. It ultimately didn't work. And I was right.
Because the face is right.
The face is always right.
Listen to the face.
But the lesson I learned was, don't fight about it. Follow it. Just go with it for a little bit. And you will see how it isn't working. But also, maybe something will come out of that that is brilliant, that does work. You know, you never get anywhere trying to stop somebody. The way to get there is to think it all the way through and follow that path. Even if it's a path that leads you into a bit of a cul-de-sac, there's going to be something you get from that, and nobody gets their feelings hurt. It's not that it's kumbaya all the time, but there is you have to have a respect for everybody in the room. And I really learned that from Renee.
Mm. That's great. So, Doug, what am I?
I think it was like late 90s, early 2000s when we were working on a Buffy episode, and we were just stuck, you know? And they were really hard to make. And all of us, the entire room was just stuck. And Joss came in, and we really wanted to please him. We had so much respect for him. And came in, and we were like, we're jammed. You know, we got nothing. You know, we're just jammed. And he said, well, South Park, bigger, longer, and uncut's playing down at the, you know, pier. Let's go see that. And we're like, can we? He's like, yeah. We're like, yeah, fuck yeah, let's go. And we watched the South Park movie, and there's one line in that was so filthy that I laughed so hard I was actually screaming. And then he said, okay, go home, see you tomorrow. And we just sat there and just laughed our asses off for the entire 90 minutes. We couldn't believe it. And what it did was it broke the tension, and it was a message to all of us. He was like, I love you guys. I know how hard you're working, and he could be very tough. I mean, he could be really tough and always correct, you know, but which he just is. But what it also said was, guys, it's us. We'll figure it out. I trust you. And we came in the next day, and in about 15 minutes, we had like 3 stories broken, you know. I wouldn't recommend that as a regular practice, you know, although that movie is really funny.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes you have to, as a showrunner, read the room and know when to do something completely unprofessional to remind everyone, it's our show, it's our circus, we're having fun, this is our school, you know? So that worked a treat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Especially now when pilots are so much more in demand than spec episodes to get jobs, how are you, when you're writing a pilot, how do you decide, okay, I want to put, this will go in the pilot, this will stay out of it, this is more for right later down the show, because you don't have the benefit of a Bible to explain what that thing is in the pilot. So how do you decide what gets in, what stays out, especially when you're writing a spec pilot?
Well, I think there's, I mean, it depends. I come from the philosophy of, you have a really great idea, and it's that pilot, and you're really trying to sell yourself in those 50 pages. I say don't hold it back. I mean, if the pilot gets picked up, you can pull it back. I mean, I think we kind of did that actually for our pilot. We ended with originally with the mid-season cliffhanger, and we had to pull that out. So I just think if you have some great idea, you know, as to where it goes. Obviously, I mean, that's not always the case. I mean, you might have mythology that, like, if you have a great enough script, you'll sit down with the execs and you can explain this is where that's going to go, and they'll be like, oh wow, that's great. But, you know, I think it's probably, if you got a really great trick, yeah, I think you should play it.
Yeah, it's like, I think, I don't know if it's urban legend, but, you know, Sean Ryan famously wrote The Shield and had that great ending where Vic Mackey kills a cop. and he said that, then they said, well, oh, that's great, we're picking it up. And what happens? He goes, Yeah.
Exactly.
So, but it was a great way to end.
That could easily have been a season finale. I mean, you could have followed that story of an undercover cop following Vic for the whole season. Yeah. But it was, you know, you got a great idea, do it.
I think you need to trust your gut, though, too. I mean, I'm speccing a pilot now, and there's nobody giving me notes, and I'm just doing it on the weekends, and there's stuff in there that I really like, but every time I read it over, I just bump on it. There's just, it's too soon for that character, or it's, you know, and you got to kill your baby. You know, you got to, if you're bumping on it, it probably doesn't belong there, even if it's awesome.
That's a good one.
You got it. Yeah. let's hear about what you guys are watching on television, what your rooms are talking about, if you are in rooms, what you're talking about with your friends or life partners or
Thrones.
Writing partners.
Everybody's talking about Thrones.
Thrones?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's start with you, Myra. What are you watching these days?
True Detective. Everybody's talking about True Detective.
We got to get... It's coming. Yeah, East Coast feed is happening.
Yeah.
What else are you watching,
House
Myra?
Of Cards just came back. I don't know if anybody's watching that, but if you watch the first episode, holy shit. you know, it's actually... It's really interesting because, you know, I was listening to what you were saying before. Is these shows, whether it's Game of Thrones or True Detective or House of Cards, they're doing new things. Like, TV's constantly evolving. Like, they
really fast these days.
Really fast. Yeah. They did this thing in the season 2 opener of House of Cards, which I didn't think you could ever do. And now that's on the table for writers in a weird way. It's like you people will reference that. Travis and I were referencing. I'm like, you can do that now, and it's pretty spectacular. I mean, it's like this renaissance of television right now. It's really
there's almost nothing you can't do. I guess actually that's there's not really any rules left.
Travis, what are you watching?
I have two kids, so less than I used to. But Walking Dead, I'm still watching, even though I think.
You're watching Downton Abbey too.
Downton Abbey. Yeah. I've been watching DVDs of The Muppets, which is actually really brilliant, and I didn't know it was quite as insanely brilliant as it is. A lot of comedy, like Community, I think is amazing. And we were just talking, like, the fact that it's resurrected itself into something maybe better than it's ever been is pretty amazing.
The lava episode was pretty special.
That was amazing. Yeah, it's just they're just firing on all cylinders. So, what else?
Doug, what are you watching?
I'm horrible. I don't watch anything.
You watch movies though.
I watch movies. I watch old movies. It's like, hey, Bonnie and Clyde, still awesome. So
that
really
counts.
Don't listen to me. But here's the thing. I don't watch. Here's the things that I need to watch. I need to watch Homeland. I need to watch Breaking Bad. I need to watch The Walking Dead. I need to watch Downton Abbey. There's a long list
of
things that
half of those
that I absolutely am told that I need to watch to have any conversation that's civil in the writer's room that I work in. And they just look at me like, what? You know, you can't see this, but it's worse than the face. the face that I get. But I have an 11-year-old son, and He watches Cartoon Network, which is genius.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have to say that I'm not really missing anything because, and I'm going to pick up one of the comic books before I go, but Henry, if you're listening to this, I'm going to get you issue number 25 of my favorite show on television, which is Adventure Time. And if you've seen Adventure Time, I mean, my God, you talk about stuff that you can do on television. I cannot wait to watch House of Cards. I did watch season one. Can't wait to binge watch all of season two. But Adventure Time, you talk about what the amount of first of all, bizarre, soup, like I've taken acid. I don't know what they're doing. Like, oh, it's trippy. No, it's not. It's they're beyond that. Way beyond that. But in addition to the stream of consciousness, I mean, Lumpy Space Princess is just... I quote her, it was my ringtone for a while, was Lumpy Space Princess, and it really annoyed everyone in the room where, because if every once in a while you forget to turn your phone off and you hear like, oh my glob, you guys, drama bomb, and I'm like, in Pendleton Ward's voice, you know, and I'm just like, well, she's a lump, but she's from space, and she thinks, I should stop talking now, right? But in addition to the stream of consciousness, which is really, truly inspiring, it is like... Joseph Campbell to a T. Within 12 minutes, they do perfect, mythic hero's journeys that are incredibly moving, and the stakes couldn't be higher, both externally, in that someone's going to die or something, like really kind of breathtaking stakes, but also emotionally, there are a couple of episodes that have really choked me up. The mythology that's underneath it and the story of the Ice King is as moving as anything I've ever seen. So... you know, more food for thought as we're all exploring what can we do. I think you guys are right on the money. Like, we're living in a golden age, and let's hammer the shit out of it. Like we can do anything, and it's the time to do it. So even children's television is spectacular genius. So that's what I'm watching.
Please give a round of applause to all of our panelists, Douglas Petrie, Travis Bickett, and Terry Metalis, and Moira Kerlin.
Just great.
Please continue clapping for 826LA and for everyone here at Nerdist Industries at Meltdown Comics. Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.